Tibetan Sage by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 7. Lobsang, Lobsang, come on, we have some work to do. I jumped up in such a hurry that I kicked away my shoes. Well, sandals. There was no such thing as shoes in Tibet. Everyone wore sandals, or, if one was riding a long way, boots which came up to the knees. Anyway, there were my sandals skittering across the floor, and I was skittering across the floor in the opposite direction. I reached the Lama, and he said, "Now, we've got to do a bit of history, true history, not the muck they put out in books, where things have been altered so that they shall not annoy any man in a powerful position." He led me into what we had come to call the world room, and we sat down at the little corner which we called the console. It really was a marvelous thing. The simulacrum of the world looked larger than the room which contained it, which everyone would know is impossible. But the Lama divined my thoughts, and he said, "Of course, when we come in here, we come under the influence of the fourth dimension, and in the fourth dimension, one can have a model which is larger than the room that contains it, if that room be of three dimensions. But let's not worry about that. Let's worry about this. What we are seeing in this world is the actual happenings of the world in years gone by. Something like an echo. You go and make a loud noise in an echo area, and you get the same sound coming back to you. Well, that's a very brief idea of what this is. It's not strictly accurate, of course, because I'm trying to tell you, in the three dimensions, what there is in the fourth and fifth. So you will have to trust your senses as to what you see, and what you see will actually be quite correct." He turned around again and then said, "We have seen the formation of the world. We have seen the very first creatures, hominids, to be placed in this world. So let us start at the next stage." The room darkened, and I felt myself falling. Instinctively, I grabbed the Lama's arm, and he put an arm around my shoulders. "It's all right, Lobsang, you're not really falling. It's just that your brain is changing to accept four dimensions." Now the falling sensation stopped, and I found myself standing in a shockingly frightening world. There were huge animals there, of an ugliness unsurpassed by anything I had seen before. Great creatures went by, flapping through the air with the most hideous sound. It sounded like old, unoiled leather. Wings which could barely support the body of the creature. But these flew around, and occasionally one went down to the ground to pick up a piece of food which had fallen from some other flying creature. But once down, they stayed down. Their wings were insufficient to get them in the air again, and they had no legs with which to help themselves. Indescribable noises came from the marsh to my left. They were shocking noises, and I felt sick with fright. And then, quite close to me out of the muck of the marsh, there emerged a tiny head on top of a vast neck. The neck must have been about 20 feet long, and there were many underwater struggles before the thing dragged itself ashore. It had a round body, and then a tail which tapered to balance the contours of the neck and head. But as I was looking at that thing, and afraid that it might be looking at me, I heard horrid crashes and cracks as if some vast thing were charging through the forest, snapping off tree trunks like we would snap a straw. I caught a glimpse of the largest creature I had ever seen. The llama said, "Let's go on a century or two and find when the humans first came." I seemed to doze or something, because when I looked at the globe again, no, of course not, I was on the globe. I was in the globe, part of it. But anyway, when I looked up again, I saw some horrid-looking creatures marching along. There were 6 of them, and they were beetle-browed, with hardly any neck, and they each carried a great chunk of tree as a weapon, tapering to a hand grip at one end, and the other end having a nice knot or burl, which would be stronger than the ordinary wood of which the trunk was composed. These creatures marched along. One, a woman, was feeding a baby at her breast as she marched, and they made not a sound, although they were going along marshy ground. There was no squelching or splashing, just complete silence. I watched them go out of sight, and then, once again, I seemed to have a doze, because when I looked up again, I saw a marvelous city. The city was made of shining stones of different colors. There were bridges across the streets, and there were mechanical birds which flew along the streets with people in them. These things could stop and hover in the air while people got in or out. Then all of a sudden, everyone turned and gazed toward the distant skyline over the mountain range. From there came a vast roaring, and soon a whole flock of these mechanical birds came along, and they circled over the city. People were running everywhere. Some were on their knees praying, but the priests, I noted, didn't stop to pray. They put all their energy into running. After some minutes of this circling, doors opened in the bottom of these mechanical things, and metal boxes fell out. The mechanical birds closed the doors in their undersides, and they sped off. The city rose up into the air and fell to the ground as dust, and then we heard the bang and the concussion, because sight is so much quicker than hearing. We heard the screams of the people trapped beneath beams or buried in dust. Again, there came a doze. This is all I can call it, a doze, because I was unaware of any break between what I had been seeing and what I was seeing now. It was a later age, and I could see a city being built, a grand city, one of surpassing beauty. It was real artistry. Spires soared high into the sky, and there were delicate traceries of metal joining one building to another. There were people about, people going about their everyday business, shopping, selling, standing on street corners and discussing things. Then there came a roaring, a terrific roaring, and an immense flock of those mechanical birds passed overhead in formation, and all the people laughed, cheered, and waved. The mechanical birds proceeded upon their way undisturbed. They crossed the mountain range, and then we heard terrible bangs and crashes, and we knew that our side were paying back the enemy for the destruction that they had caused. But, mechanical birds were returning, or not returning, because they were not ours, they were different. Some were of different shapes, and many were of different colors, and they came over our city, and they dropped their bombs again. Our city was swept by a firestorm. The fire roared and raged, and everything in the city burned and fell to the ground. Delicate traceries of bridges turned red and then white, and then they melted, and the liquid metal fell like rain. Soon I was standing on a plain, the only thing there. There were no trees, the artificial lakes had gone, turned into steam, and I stood there and I looked about me and I wondered, what was the sense of it all? Why were these gardeners of the earth fighting against other gardeners? I could not make any sense out of all of it. Then the world itself shook and darkened. I found myself sitting on a chair beside the Lama Mingyur Dondup. He was looking sadder than I had ever seen anyone look before. Lobsang, this has happened on this world for millions of years. There have been people of a high degree of culture, but somehow they have shelled the other side so that only a few humans were left, and they hid in caves, and in a few years they crept out to start again with a fresh civilization, and that civilization in its turn would be destroyed, and all the remnants would be plowed deep into the soil by the farmers who were trying to grow crops in the battle-torn land. The Lama looked exceedingly sad, and he sat with his chin cupped in his hands. And then he said, I could show you the whole history of the world, but it would take the whole of your lifetime to view it. So I will only show you some flashes, as we call it, and I will tell you about others. It's a very sad thing, but various types of people have been tried as settlers on this world. There has been an all-black race, and it came after a big turmoil. Two white races had been quarreling as to who was the most powerful, and, of course, they resorted to warfare. It's always warfare, always the evil thoughts of people. If people would only believe in a god, there would be none of this trouble. But this all-black race made a horrible mess of things on the world until at last they reached a very high degree of civilization, far higher than our civilization now. But then two different races of the black people quarreled, and they sought frantically to get a more powerful weapon than their opponents. Well, they did, and somehow the signal was given to release these, well, rocket things. And that caused tremendous trouble on this world. Most of the people were wiped out, just wiped out, like one would kill off a colony of fierce ants. Always there are some survivors, and so now we have a white race, a black race, and a yellow race. At one time there was a green race. People in those days lived for hundreds of years because their memory cells were able to reproduce dying cells with exactitude. It is only since the cells lost their ability to reproduce accurately that we have such short lives. But in one of the wars, there were tremendous explosions, and most of the cloud cover of the earth was blown away. Blown away into space, and the sunlight came pouring in with all the lethal rays. And instead of people living 700 or 800 years, their lifespan was just about 70 years. The sun isn't the kind, benevolent provider of sunlight, etc. It sends out rays which cause harm to people. You can see for yourself that people exposed to the sunlight too much have their skin turn dark. Now, if it was good to have sunlight, then nature would not need to make a shield against the light. But the rays, ultraviolet and others, affected the humans and made them worse, and the two sets of gardeners of the earth became even fiercer. One side was good and wanted to see the human race grow fruitful and do much good. Instead of that, people exposed to too much sunlight used to get TB or cancer. All the surfaces of the world, or rather, all the surfaces of the people of the world, were prone to diseases, skin diseases of various forms, and they were tenacious. There was no cure for them. After all, these rays could penetrate many feet of stone, and it was useless for the inhabitants of the world to live in houses, because the rays could still reach them. There is an old saying that there were giants in those days, and yes, that is true. The giants were one set of the gardeners of the earth. They stood 2 to 3 times the height of the average human, and they were slow-moving, somewhat lethargic, and did not like to work. They tried to get back to their home base, but when they tried, they found that there had been troubles on the home base. One set of gardeners were good and with a good leader, but the other side was a bad side. They thrived on wickedness of all kinds, and they were immune to the appeals of those who wanted a peaceful world with a more healthy lifespan. These good gardeners saw how useless it was to stay at their home base, so they reprovisioned their ships and put in fresh fuel rods, and they took off again for Earth. Their ships could travel faster than light. They could travel so fast that no human could control them, and they had to be worked by a form of computer which had a special shield to keep away meteorites or other obstructions. Otherwise, without these shields, the ships would have been riddled with meteorites, or cosmic dust, resulting, of course, in the loss of air and death of all aboard. At last, they got back to the Earth and they found another war in progress. The wrong side, the bad part of the gardeners of the Earth, had mixed too freely with the Earth people and taught them many of their secrets. Since those days, the world has been getting worse and worse, and there will have to be a fresh world war during which many will die. Many more will go into hiding in caves or in a high mountain cleft. They were told by their sages of all that was going to happen, so they took the view, what was the good of living a good life when in a few short years perhaps the Earth itself would be destroyed? And we are getting perilously close to that time now. I listened to all this, and then I said, I have been told by the head astrologer that I am going to have an awful life, a really sick life. Now how's that going to help the world? The Lama said, yes, everything the head astrologer said has come to pass, and it is true that you are going to have a very, very bad time with everyone's hand against you. But always remember that you will succeed in what you are doing, and when you leave this world, you will not be stuck in the astral, you will go to a much higher station. And, of course, you will never return to the Earth. I'm not sure if it's time yet to tell you of all the things that are going to happen here, but let us have a look at some of the events of the past. I think, though, that first we should have a meal, because these three-dimension pictorial realizations tire one, and one forgets the time. We were true to our native food sampa and cold water to drink, but then, the Lama said, you will have to get used to different food, because in other parts of the world they do not know anything at all about sampa. They have food which is pre-cooked, sealed in a can, and as long as the can is kept intact, the food is edible, no matter how long it's kept before eating. But, of course, one also has to keep the cans at a cold temperature. That stops the decay. Nowadays in the West, they use what they call ice boxes, great big boxes packed with ice, which surrounds the cans of food, and every few days the boxes have to be opened to see how much of the ice has melted. If a lot has melted, then the whole box has to be repacked with fresh ice. You can always tell, though, when the food has gone bad because the cans will bulge, showing that there is a gas pressure, the gas of decomposition inside. And then one has to throw away such cans or be poisoned. Now let us clean our bowls, and then we'll look again at the world of which we are part. The Lama rose to his feet and scraped away the remnants of sampa. Then he went to his little pile of sand, took a handful, cleaned his bowl with it. I followed suit, and I thought what an awful chore it was, having to clean dishes every time. I wondered why no one had invented something to hold food and then be discarded when the food upon it had been eaten. I thought of all the monks and all the lamas busy with their hands full of fine sand. But that is a lot more healthy than washing a wooden bowl, you know. If you have a thing wet, then obviously it's going to seep into the wood. And suppose you have some nice juicy fruit in your bowl. You eat the fruit and then there's some juice left, and if you go and wash that bowl, then you are saturating the wood and allowing the juices to enter. No, until there's a better system, very fine sand is much, much better than water. How long do you think this world has been a world, sir? The lama smiled at me and said, Well, you have already seen part of it, and I think we ought to see a bit more of the world, past, present, and future, don't you? We walked slowly towards the great hall or room where the simulacrum of the world lay waiting to be used. You know, Lobsang, we all tend to think that this world is forever and ever, and yet this universe is actually being destroyed now. It has been established quite definitely that all the worlds are rushing away from each other. Now, really the best way to explain it is to tell you again that the time on this world is entirely artificial. The real time is space-time. And do you remember those fuses which I showed you, and which could be struck on something rough, and the end would explode into flame? Well, if you are a god in space, the birth, life, and death of this world, or any other world, would resemble the striking of that fuse. First, there's the heat engendered by the friction of the fuse point on something hard. Then the point bursts into flame, and then the flame dies out, and you've got just a red-hot head to the fuse, which quickly cools to become just a black, burned mass. Earth is like that, and all the other planets. To us, living on this earth, the earth seems forever, but supposing you had a minute person who could be placed on the head of the fuse as it was cooling, he would think that he was living on a world which would exist forever and forever. Do you get what I'm driving at? Yes, sir, I do. I was told by a lama who had been to a big school in Germany, and he said that a fuse simile is appropriate. He used almost the same words as you, but he added that after several million years, the head of the match, or the world, would reach about 20 million degrees Fahrenheit because it needs a certain temperature before the hydrogen in the atmosphere can be converted to carbon, oxygen, and various other elements. All these elements are necessary in the formation of the world. He told me also that before the end of the world globe swells. Yes, that is absolutely true. You have to remember that in the Western world, they do not know of these things because they haven't anything like we have here. Here we actually have the instruments which super scientists of perhaps a billion years ago built. built to last a billion years or more. These machines have stood here throughout the hundreds, throughout the thousands of centuries, until someone came along who knew how to work them. I know how to work them, Lobsang, and I'm going to teach you, and you're going to have a life of hardship, so that you know what the world is really like. And because of the teaching, which you can take back to Patra, you can make it easier for other worlds. But, sir, you have mentioned the word Patra, but I know of no world with that name, I said. No, I'm aware of that, but you will do before long. I'm going to show you Patra in this world, but there are so many things to see first, and I have always found it to be useless to have an instrument which would produce predictable results. But then, if the operator did not know how to work the machine and how the final result was arrived at, then he would be a very poor operator indeed. No instrument should be used unless the prospective operator can do the things which the instrument has been designed to do. We reached the room. It should be called a hall, really, because of the size of it. But we reached the room, or hall, or whatever you want to call it, and we entered. Immediately, there was a faint glow, and we saw dawn beginning to turn to daylight. It was a different sort of dawn than we should see now, because now all those glorious colors which we see at sunrise and sunset are merely reflections from the pollution in the atmosphere. In those days, the pollution was actually food for the earth, food for the soil being spewed out onto the land from the volcanoes, and it is these volcanoes which gave the seas their salt content. Without salt, one could not live. We sat down by that console thing, and the Lama Mingyur Dondup said, "Let us look at some random spots. We've got all the time we need. They will probably be glad to get us out of their way, especially you, you young wretch, dropping things on people's bald heads. But in the early days, animals, the first form of life on earth, were weird creatures indeed. For instance, the Brachiosaurus was probably the strangest creature that has ever been seen on this earth. There are all manner of strange things. For example, Ultrasaurus was the most peculiar animal. It would have a very high blood pressure because its head could be more than 60 feet in the air, and furthermore, that animal weighed about 80 tons, and it had 2 brains. The one in the head moved the jaws and the front legs, and the one at its behind, that is, right behind the pelvis, was there to work the tail and rear legs. It always reminds me of a question I was asked. What happens if a centipede gets its legs out of step? Well, that is a question I could not answer with any degree of accuracy. I could only say that perhaps the creature had some special other creature watching over it to see that it didn't go cross-legged. Well, love sang, what shall we look at? We have ample time, and so tell me, what do you want to see most? I thought for a time, and then I said, that Japanese lama we had, he told us a lot of peculiar things. I still don't know whether to believe him or not. He told us that the world was once very hot, and then all of a sudden it became very cold, and the surface of the world was covered with ice. Can we see that? Yes, of course we can. There's no difficulty at all. But you know, this has happened several times. You see, the world is billions of years old, and every so many millions of years there is an ice age. For instance, at the North Pole now, there's a depth of ice in the water of 600 feet, and if all the ice melted, and the icebergs also melted, everyone on Earth would be drowned, because the land would be inundated. Well, except for we of Tibet, we would be too high for the water to reach. He turned to the console and looked up a whole column of figures. And then the light in the big room, or hall, whatever you want to call it, dimmed. For seconds we were in darkness, and then there came a reddish glow, most peculiar, absolutely peculiar, and from the poles, the north and the south poles, there came variegated streaks of light. That is the Aurora Borealis, or Aura of the World. We can see it because although we appear to be on Earth, we are away from that manifestation. That is why we see it. The light grew brighter. It grew dazzling bright, so bright that we had to view it through almost closed eyes. Where is Tibet? I asked. We are standing on it, Lobsang. We are standing on it. All that you are looking at down there is ice. I was looking at that ice, wondering what it would be, because there was green ice, there was blue ice, there was absolutely transparent ice, as transparent as the clearest of clear water. I just could not make it out, so I said, I've seen enough of that. That's a dismal sight. The lama laughed and turned back to the things on the console, and the world turned and flickered with speed. Then it was turning so fast that everything was gray. There was no darkness, no lightness, only this gray impression. And then the world slowed down, and we found that we were looking at a great city, a fantastic city. It was a city built just before the advent of the Sumerians. It was built by a race of whose existence there is now no written trace, nothing in history about it, and in fact there was only the remotest mention of Sumerians in the history books. But they came as conquerors, and they looted, raped, and ravished the city, and having reduced it to a state when no stone stood upon another stone, they moved on, and according to the history books, they moved out somewhere, and no trace has ever been found. No, of course not, because they moved away, and they moved off the Earth in huge spaceships. I could not understand why these people should be so savage as to come and destroy a city. Well, apparently for the fun of it. Of course, they took a lot of women prisoners, and that might have been some of the reason. It occurred to me that I was looking at something which could change the whole history of mankind. Master, I said, I have been looking at all these things, looking at all these wonderful, wonderful inventions, but it seems that only a very few people know about them. Now, surely if everyone knew about them, we could have a time when there would be peace throughout the world, because what would there be to fight about if everything could be known through these instruments or machines? No, Lobsang, it is not so, old man, it is not so. If there was any thought that people would know about this, then crooked financiers would rush in with their armed guards, and they would seize all of this and kill all of us who know about it. And then they would use the instruments to control the world. Think of it, a crooked capitalist being king of the world, and everyone else would be his slave. Well, I can't understand the attitude of people, because we know Tibet's going to be invaded by the Chinese. We know they're going to take all our treasured books away to study. What's to prevent them from capturing the world? Lobsang, my dear friend, you must be very, very simple, weak in the head or something. You don't think we would let any conqueror get a hold of things like this, do you? To start with, we have absolute duplicates of these right up in the high Arctic, where men can hardly manage to move because of the cold. But inside the mountain ranges there, everything is warm and peaceful and comfortable, and we would have eyes on the world. We could see just what was happening, and if necessary, we could take some action. But this stuff here, he gestured round, all this will be wrecked, blown up, even booby-trapped. First, the British and the Russians will try to capture Tibet, and they will fail. They will cause a terrible amount of deaths, but they will fail to conquer. But they will give the Chinese the idea of how to succeed, and the Chinese will come, and they will conquer Tibet, conquer part of it, that is. But still, they will not get any of these machines. They will not get any of the holy books or the medical books, because we've known of this for years, for centuries, actually, and false books have been prepared, and they are ready to be put in place as soon as the Chinese start to invade. The prophecy, you know, says that Tibet will survive until wheels come to our country, and when the wheels come to Tibet, that will be the end of our country. So have no fear. All our treasures, all our great sciences from a few million years ago are safely hidden. I know the location. I have been there. And you too are going to know the location, because you are going to be shown. I shall be killed in your lifetime, in fact, before you leave Tibet. and you will be one of the very, very few who can work these machines and who knows how to service them." "Good gracious, sir! To learn to service these machines would take several lifetimes." "No, you will learn that they are self-repairing. You have to do just a few manipulations, and the machine, or rather other machines, will repair the faulty machine. You see, they won't have much longer to live, these machines, because starting in several years' time, in 1985, circumstances will change, and there will be a Third World War, which will last for quite a time. And after the year 2000, there will be many, many changes, some for the better, some for the worse. We are able to see, through the Akashic Record of Probabilities. Now, man is not on rails, you know, unable to deviate from a certain path. Man has free choice within certain limits, those limits being set by the astrological type of the person. But we can very accurately see what happens to a country, and that is what we shall soon be doing, because I want you to see some of the wonders of the world. We will tune in to different situations, to different times. But, sir, how is it possible for you to tune in to sounds which have long passed by? Sounds, pictures, and all that. When the thing has happened, it is done and finished with. No, Lobsang, not so, not so. Matter is indestructible, and the impressions of what we say or do go out from us and circle the universe, and circle the universe again and again. With this big machine, we can go back to about 2 billion years. Mind, at 2 billion years, the picture's a bit hazy, but it's still bright enough for us to make out what it is. "Well, I can't understand," I said, "how one can pick up pictures and sounds out of nothingness." Lobsang, in a few years to come, there will be something called wireless. It is being invented now, and with it one can pick up what will be called radio programs. And if the receiver is good enough, you can pick up from any transmitter in the world, and later still, they will have these radio boxes which can pick up pictures. It has all been done before, but as civilization succeeds civilization, sometimes the same things are reinvented. Sometimes an improved version results, but in this case, apparently, the thing called wireless is giving a lot of trouble, because the information has to be brought from the astral world by scientists who think they invented it. But anyway, you just take my word for it, and we can go on and see what is going to happen in the world. Unfortunately, our upper limit will be 3,000 years. Beyond that, no, we cannot reach. Our pictures are too hazy, too muzzy for us to decipher them. But you are going to have a lot of suffering and a lot of traveling, and you are going to be the victim of various unscrupulous people who will not like what you are doing, and so they will try to blacken your character. On this machine, within the next few days, you're going to see quite a lot of the highlights of your career. But let us just look at some odds by tuning in to things at random. Now, look, here is the important happenings in a place called Egypt. The Lama adjusted various controls, and we saw darkness, and up on the skyline of the darkness, there were some black triangles. It didn't make sense to me at all. So he gradually advanced one control, and the world gradually came into daylight. He said, "Look, this is the building of the pyramids. People will wonder and wonder in later years how ever these great blocks of stone were moved around without all sorts of machinery. They are moved by levitation." "Yes, sir," I replied, "I've heard a lot about levitation, but I haven't the faintest idea how it works." "Well, you see, the world has a magnetic pull, and if you throw a thing up into the air, the magnetism of the earth pulls it down again. If you fall out of a tree, you fall down, not up, because the magnetism of the earth is such that you must fall to the earth. But we have a thing which is anti-magnetic to the earth. We have to keep them very carefully under guard the whole time, because if an untrained person got hold of one of these things, he could find that he had floated right out of the earth. The fall then is upwards. How we control it is by having two grids. One is tuned to the magnetism of the earth, the other is opposed to the magnetism of the earth. Now, when the grids are in a certain position, the plates will float. They will not go up, they will not go down. But if you push a lever which alters the relationship of the grids to each other, then in one direction the lever makes the earth magnetism the stronger. And so the plates or machine sink down to the earth. But if we want to rise up, then we push the lever the other way, so that the anti-magnetism takes effect and the earth repels instead of attracts. And so we can rise up into the air. It is the thing the gods used when they were making this world as it is now. One man could lift up these 100-ton blocks and put them in position without exerting himself. And then, when the block was in the precise position desired, the magnetic current would be switched off and the block would be locked in position by the pull of gravity of the earth. That is how the pyramids were built. That is how many strange things, unaccountable things, were built. For example, we have had maps of the earth for centuries, and we are the only people who have these maps because we alone have these anti-gravity devices, and they have been used to map the world exactly. But this is no time to be discussing things. I think we should have a meal, and then we will look at my legs, and after that, let us go to sleep, for there is a brand new day tomorrow, a day you have never seen before. End of chapter 7.